changing the conversation on social rejection.
What we like to do with our movie is that we would like to give people different words to engage in this conversation, which is this idea of social exclusion, rejection, ostracism. And then also the other piece of our film is looking at having those conversations of tolerance and acceptance at a very young age.
That's Ruth Thomas Sir. We talk with her about her powerful new film, Reject. Joining the conversation is her father, Herbert Thomas. He's the author of The Shame Response to Rejection. And later, we talk with environmental journalist John Cushman about what's really in the just-released State Department report on the Keystone XL pipeline. It's not necessarily what you think. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Bullying is a serious and growing problem in today's schools and online, and awareness of it and attempts to stop it are increasing. But bullying is just one part of the much larger phenomenon of social rejection, and the impact of rejection is devastating, whether it's experienced as a child or an adult. Moreover, children who are rejected by their peers experience a fallout well into adulthood, at higher risk for depression and even physical illnesses like cancer and heart disease. In fact, rejection hurts. And I don't mean that as a metaphor. As my guests Ruth Thomas Sir and Herbert Thomas explain, when we're rejected by those around us, the pain centers of our brains are activated identically to a physical assault. In her wonderful film, Reject, Ruth Thomas Sir sets out to tell the stories of two children, one who succumbed to the pain and committed suicide at age 17, the other, much younger, who was caught early enough and put into a loving classroom that demanded universal acceptance, where he flourished. She also tells the scientific story of rejection. Ruth Thomas Sir was inspired in part by the work her father did as a psychologist in a maximum security prison, where he began exploring the connection between rejection, shame, and inmate violence. Herbert Thomas's 1997 book is The Shame Response to Rejection, and he joins us as well. Ruth Thomas Sir, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. I'm really honored to be here.
And Herb Thomas, welcome as well.
Yes, I too am honored to be here.
Well, this film, you know, I'm not even sure how to pronounce it. Is it Reject or Reject?
Well, you can say it either way. We usually say reject, but the whole point of using the word that it could be a verb or a noun, and really people can pronounce it either way.
It's a very powerful film, and one that really seems to cover all the bases, even some very new ones. What I found so telling was the way you weave the personal stories into the science of the film. And you begin with a story of a young man who killed himself at the age of 17. This is a story that really provides the spine on which the movie is unrolls. Tell us about this boy.
Sure. The boy is Eric Mohat, and it's a family, the Mohat family from Mentor, Ohio, which is a little bit outside of Cleveland, about a half an hour. And in, I believe it was 2007, Eric took his life. It was about 9 months into his senior year of high school. And according to witnesses and the story which came out later over time, it was only when they were at the funeral and the family was standing in the receiving line that children started to come up to them and tell them stories about how Eric had been bullied. And they just kept hearing whispers of the math class. And the death came as, you can't understate what a shock it came at to this family. This is a very happy family. They were very close. Eric was about to go traveling, I think, to Hawaii with his mother as a chaperone. Best friends with his sister. She had no idea what was going on. So apparently you can really call this bullying, because there were physical things going on. There was verbal taunting, and it went on day after day after day in this particular math class. And another piece of the story is that there was something with a group of friends, really maybe some of the core rejection, which is the group that he really had relied on to be his support maybe ostracized him out of the group. And I think it was a perfect storm. I think it really was just maybe the straw that broke the camel's back for him. So the family, Jan Mohack came home from work to find the police in her driveway. And which is, of course, every person, you can barely even think about it. I mean, it's every parent's worst nightmare. And Bill Mohack got a call from at work, and they just said, you need to come home now. Your son's been in an accident. So what we did in the film is try to show what it's like to go through this as a family. There's more backstory to this story, which is there were at least four other suicides at this school in a period of 3 years. The story that I wanted to tell with Eric Mohat was, what does it feel like to go through something like this? And if people really knew what it felt like, maybe we would teach our children differently.
And of course, it's something that's so, even now, minimized, even though bullying is becoming more into focus in our society today. The sea change really hasn't happened in terms of people taking it completely seriously. Evidently, this school must have been a place where that happened as well.
I think it's cultural. Again, my story wasn't as much about the school. I know that they had taken certain steps towards anti-bullying. The good news is that the school has taken even more steps now, and Bill Mohat has been back to the school and talked to them about additional things that they could do. So there's been some rapprochement there, if you will. But I think what we like to do with our movie is that we'd like to give people different words to engage in this conversation, which is this idea of social exclusion, rejection, ostracism. And then also the other piece of our film is looking at having those conversations of tolerance and acceptance at a very young age. So we completely support the anti-bullying conversation. At the same time, now we think it's time for another conversation that really looks at root causes, which can create victims and even bullies, and to also look at some of the solutions for that.
Root causes, say a little bit more about that. And also, we have your father here for a reason, because you, Herb, have written about rejection and the impact that it has. Do you have some idea about root causes?
Well, I think what Ruth is talking about is the whole issue of the physical response to rejection, which can be extreme pain under certain circumstances, which are very briefly these. If you're rejected by a significant other in front of significant others, and particularly if it's a surprise, and also if it's of your whole self and not just an aspect of self, that, when it comes together in a particular way, it can cause physical pain. And it's that physical pain that leads to really rejecting others and ultimately becoming violent. So it's the whole layer underneath what people generally talk about as bullying.
So put this together. We think of social causes of bullying, but you have this kind of connection between different layers. There is the physical layer, how we respond to rejection. How does society construct rejection in a way that causes that kind of pain and makes us less resilient to it? Talk about some of those things that you found in the course of doing this movie, Reject.
Absolutely. We have two different stories in the film laid against the science. And quite simply, if you look at Eric Mohat's story, it's a story of a person who was in an atmosphere of rejection, basically. And his included bullying. There was also some ostracism going on. And, Eric took his life. And in contrast, we have little Justin's story, who's a 5-year-old boy who was recently, well, in the movie, you see that he's just been kicked out of his kindergarten. And you saw the new trajectory of his life based on being in an atmosphere which was very, very strong boundaries, very strict, but also full of love and full of acceptance. And We just saw a story where this little child, the trajectory of his life has completely changed, and who knows where he was headed. You know, before he was asked to leave kindergarten, he was in the principal's office every day. There were a lot of complaints about him. He wasn't doing well. He was sort of spiraling downward. I think quite simply, it's environments of acceptance versus rejection, whether it's in a family atmosphere, whether it's at school, whether it's in the office, whether it's a team. And we can create environments where people feel accepted versus rejected. And I think the most important point is that if the experiences of ostracism, exclusion, and rejection cause not just emotional pain, but physical pain in the laboratory when people are testing that, and you look at what we experience in the world on a day-to-day basis, with just very slight changes, we can see incredible results. And I think we can see a decrease in bullying. I mean, there are studies that are already showing that.
We're speaking with Ruth Thomas about her film Reject, or Reject, and also with her dad, Herb Thomas. He wrote the book, The Shame Response to Rejection. And I'm going to get to the connection between the two of you in a moment. But first, I want to talk about a book that you feature in the film. I think this is a good place to bring it in. And that is a book that was written by a teacher, you know, about 20 years ago. The title is You Can't Say You Can't Play. This is a philosophy and a rule that was put into effect in the classroom that you just spoke about. Talk about this book, the teacher who did it, and how this is being used in the classroom.
So Vivian Paley, the well-known educator, I'm sure she hates the title, but MacArthur genius, she taught at the University of Chicago Lab School for 40 years. And one of the many books she wrote was You Can't Say You Can't Play, which was about an experiment she did in her kindergarten classroom where children were not allowed to tell the other children, you can't play with us. Now, for immediately people's response is, oh, you know, you have to be able to choose your friends, and that sounds like communism. I mean, we've heard some really interesting remarks about that. But Ms. Paley's view is that this is a classroom. This is not your home. It's not a playground outside of school. These are places where children are supposed to feel safe. They're supposed to feel included, even at the youngest of ages. So when young children are feeling in kindergarten or nursery school that they're already being pushed out, that there's something different, that I'm not accepted, and teachers sort of just ignoring it or letting it happen, Vivian Paley's view was that, well, that was not acceptable. And it was preceded by her viewing the negative impacts on children who she did perceive that they felt rejected in the classroom. So that's how she came up with the rule. She did the experiment and she wrote about it so beautifully in You Can't Say You Can't Play.
And the kids didn't like it at first either.
No, they didn't. And in fact, one little girl said, well, what would be the point of playing if we couldn't have, you know, if we couldn't choose who we want to play with? And I think it does go against our nature in some ways. The flip side of it is that something beautiful came out of it, something incredibly, something to make you think. And she said, you know, there was resistance. There were some kids who were very relieved. They looked very relieved that this was going to be happening while somebody actually gets this and is in charge and is going to be handling this. And it took some time, and I recommend that everybody read the book because she weaves a beautiful fairy tale throughout the book that she used to explain some of these concepts to the children. But the end result was that she saw this incredible creativity happen when this rule was in place. And all of a sudden, little children who maybe they wouldn't play a certain role, or they wouldn't play the policeman in playtime or something, or they wouldn't be the mother, or just different things. People were trying on different roles and also developing ways of conflict resolution by themselves. So Vivian Paley graciously agreed to be in the film. And she talks about You Can't Say You Can't Play, and she talks about the impact of rejection. And I would love to tell the story of how Vivian Paley came to be in the film. When my children were at preschool here in New York City, the director assigned the parents the book You Can't Say You Can't Play. And I read the first page of the book, and I think 5 minutes later, I called my father, and I said, this is exactly what you talk about. She was even using the word rejection, and she was saying it has lifelong impact, and why don't we do something to handle it? So I called him and I said, she's talking about what you're talking about was in the play yard versus the prison yard, because my father was a prison psychiatrist for 30 years. So he and I discussed it. We met for lunch. And at that lunch, he actually handed me a tear sheet or a printout of the experiment that had been done at UCLA, connecting the experiences of rejection to physical pain, which he had talked about for years and years. So between my father's work and his book and Vivian Paley coming at it from a view of an educator, and then finding out the science is actually happening now to support these ideas, the idea of the documentary came together.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what does happen in the brain. And there's a very interesting computer experiment.
So yes, we feature the work of Dr. Kipling Williams from Purdue University, and he created a game called Cyberball, which at first looks like it is a very basic game if you look at it. It's stick figures on the computer, and they are throwing the ball. There's sort of a three-way ball toss, and if you were participating, Francesca, you would be the third person, and essentially they would stop throwing you the ball. So the long and short of it is Dr. Williams' work with Cyberball. He met Naomi Eisenberger and Matthew Lieberman, who are more neuropsychologists from UCLA. They met at a conference, and they decided to use the Cyberball game when their brains were being scanned to see what happened. And even to their surprise, what happened was the area of your brain that usually lights up when you're in physical pain was lighting up when people were getting excluded or rejected from this very basic ball tossing game. So it's interesting because not only did it show up as physical pain in the brain, but people had many things to say about it. They just found it very upsetting, or they found that they really had to spend a long time talking to certain people about what had just happened and to say that they had to debrief them, in other words, from after this very basic experience, to say you weren't really rejected by anybody, it wasn't anyone in the other room. Basically, they were trying to make the experience of rejection as minimal as possible and to see the effects. And if in the movie, I think you can see that. You can see how minimal this game is and the, you know, incredible effects, the incredibly large effects that it has on people.
Mm. Ruth Thomas, her movie is Reject. Now, Herb Thomas, you have been working, or you worked for many, many years in prison population. How did your experience there lead to your interest in this whole experience of ostracism and social rejection?
Well, I started working in a maximum security prison. I went there in 1959 to Jackson Prison, holding at the time about 4,000 men, with another 1,000 men outside in a pre-release camp. And there was, at that time, a mode of work in these maximum security prisons in which they were controlled by the officers on the walls of the prison, and inside the prison, anything went. And so I learned a lot about violence and rejection and being shamed.
Yeah, make the connection between rejection, shame, and violence in what you saw in the prison. And you speak in one paper of some examples. One that struck me was of an inmate who approaches you and another person from the prison you are talking with the other person at the prison. He approaches kind of in a very lighthearted way. He's wearing a chef's hat. He's coming to serve you. What happened and what was his response?
Well, there were three of us at a table in the cafeteria when this man approached us. One was a senior major of the guard, actually, and the other one was a senior administrator, I think an assistant superintendent, myself. And we were talking about something that was very threatening, namely the concern that there would be a major riot in the prison. And this chap came over, and as you said, he came over very lighthearted with a chef's hat where he'd got somewhere and wanted to offer us some coffee, at which point he got cursed out by one of the other men.
One of the prison officials.
One of the prison officers. And that hit him. You could see the change in his face. He was from lighthearted, he became very white and then very red-faced, walked off behind the cafeteria serving counter and stood there watching me, and I kept watching him. So our eyes never lost that direct gaze. And as we were doing that, the steward came in, a short little man, and stood beside him, I assume saying, "Why aren't you working?" And this inmate, who was a big, big man, just reached his arm around his neck and picked the warden up, the steward up off the floor. This man and the steward and I were all staring at each other.
When you were looking at the inmate, were you looking angrily or just stone-faced, or were you friendly?
Oh, no, as accepting and as loving as I'm capable of doing. So I decided, well, I'll put this huge grin on my face, which I did. And there was a moment, and then both those men stared back at me with the big smiles on their face. And there was another moment, and the inmate put the steward down on the floor, and he walked off, sort of shaking himself off. So we had a good relationship. There had always been a good relationship between myself and those two men. So we built on that relationship. But I really had it directly confronting me when in the yard, another officer and myself were walking across the yard. There was nobody around. And this inmate approaches us, and the officer with me, who was a fine person, I liked him very much, he's a good friend, he started yelling at this inmate as he got closer to us, and I cursing him out. I couldn't believe what he was doing. So the fellow stopped, the inmate stopped, his face went white, and then again it gradually went red, and he just marched off, apparently went to his cell. And that is about as clear an example of rejection as I could bring up right at the moment. And what happened was that this inmate went to his cell, got out a shank, a knife, and stabbed the first correctional officer that confronted him 27 times. But God, thank God, the man didn't die.
What's so interesting to me about the story that you tell, Herb, and how it illuminates some of the things in your film, Ruth, is that, you know, we know of prisons in this country as being, you know, incubators for shame. I mean, shame is the MO. It's what the system runs on. And there is so much violence in the prisons. This whole culture of shame that I think in some ways replicates a culture of shame that we have in the larger country. I wonder if you have some thoughts on that.
Well, there is a culture of shame, I believe. You know, we have Jim Garbarino in the film, and I just thought I'd mention, because he's another man who's worked extensively in prisons, and now he mainly works with men on death row. Now, this is, bear with me for a minute, because this is a little going off track a little bit, but we do talk about parental rejection in the film. And Jim said that the common denominator that he sees for men on death row is maternal rejection. So that comment didn't make it into the movie. There's only so much that you can put in. And that's part of another conversation about how we parent. A goal that we wanted to achieve in the movie is to really have it be a conversation where each of us can watch it and look at our own behavior. I mean, including as the director of the film, I have to look at how I am as a mother, as a friend, as a wife, as a business person. So I think, you know, in terms of the culture that's there, you know, our movie's about rejection, but it really is about acceptance, the power of acceptance, inclusion, tolerance in schools, in homes. So, you know, we're trying not to finger point, we're trying not to judge, but I think we can all just look at what's happening. Look at school shootings, look at suicides. Youth suicide has gone from the number 3 cause of death to the number 2 cause of death. So there's something going on, and people feeling isolated, people feeling not part of a community or not just important. One other thing I'd like to say is I think people look at this information and some people go, oh, that's wishy-washy or it's for losers. And, you know, even in the classroom that we filmed in Stillwater, Oklahoma, that teacher had very high standards. She had very high expectations for those children. She had that entire kindergarten reading. This is a Title I school. There are 26 languages spoken there. At the same time, this culture of acceptance and tolerance that she imbued into the classroom, well, you can just see it for yourself.
She's a remarkable teacher. You see the love that she has for her children, and as you say, the firmness as well. But the point that she makes, and we're also concerned about teaching to the test and high standards. Kids who are bullied can't learn. Kids who feel shame, kids who are connected with all this kind of anger and resentment and rejection cannot learn.
They cannot learn, Francesca. And it's not just me saying that. There's actually a lot of research supports that kids who are excluded, not just bullied, yes, bullied, but also excluded, rejected, ostracized, they cannot learn. And even worse, it leads to juvenile delinquency, higher dropout rates. There's research that shows it even lowers your IQ. And it's like, you know, do humans do better with or without love? And it's not about, you know, Terry Varnell happened to be a teacher who hugged her children. And, you know, people watched the movie and said, oh, my gosh, I would be fired if I was doing that. And it's not allowed anymore. But there are many ways to show tolerance and acceptance, and maybe more importantly, to teach the kids how to respect each other. In Terry's classroom, the children were taking it on themselves. So she had the rule, you can't say you can't play. And one day she came over in the cafeteria and then they said, oh, Miss Varnell, we came up with a new rule, and it's you can't say you can't sit. Because somebody come over, they wanted to sit down, and the kids had said, no, you can't sit here, as children do. And the other children said, no, he can sit here, and we're going to have a rule now, which is you can't say you can't sit. So I think the children see a power in it. And that doesn't mean they're not still going to do it, but just putting it into the conversation creates a very different atmosphere.
And there's a marvelous little vignette in the film where her class is out on the playground, and a little girl comes to her complaining that some other girls are not letting her play with them. And she doesn't just take the girl's word for it. She explores a little bit. Okay, so what's going on here? And it turns out what's happening is that the little girl actually wants the other kids to play her game. And they're involved in another game, so they don't want to play her game. And it takes a couple of iterations of her sending the girl back and saying, ask them if you can join their game, when she finally does get it, and then it's like, oh yeah. Now, I want to ask you, you were filming that. What was going through your mind as that was happening?
Let me first say, I think it's probably the best example of perceived rejection that we have in the movie. So there's real rejection. You know, there are times when people really are telling us we're a jerk, or, you know, there are real examples that are quite clear. And then there are also examples where we perceive that we're being rejected, and they can be as painful as actually being rejected, and they're very real for people. We had done individual interviews with every little child to ask them about you can't say you can't play, and most of them are done in front of a big flower. Well, Savannah, we hadn't had a chance to interview her yet, so we asked Miss Varnell if we could interview her outside near the playground. Well, she started talking about recess, and I think she said, you know, I really don't like this. The kids won't play with me, or those kids wouldn't play with me right now, or something like that. So I actually remember her asking her, you know, I said, well, go on over, or maybe you can talk to Miss Varnell about it. You know, I think she could probably help you. So we ran over following her with her microphone hanging down the back, and I couldn't completely hear what was going on. So I didn't even really know what we had until we got back to watch it.
And you must have been thrilled.
We were really thrilled. I think all of us can relate to that moment where we're like, oh my goodness, you know, am I being excluded? Am I being asked to play? And also we saw how Miss Varnell did not intervene and say, no, you must play with her. Just the way that she handled it, and to say, well, you know, see what they're doing. Did you ask them to play your game, or were you trying to join their game? And just this gentle steering of this child is so powerful, mm-hmm. But also that I'm sure they're going to include you. I mean, that is her rule.
Ruth Thomas-Suh, We'll be back with her and her father, Herbert Thomas, after the break. Don't go away.
You, who are on the road, must have a code that you can live by. And so, become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking about social rejection and its impact on children, on the adults they grow into, and on anyone who experiences rejection in their life. We're also talking about a new national conversation about creating inclusion and acceptance. It's being promoted by my guest, Ruth Thomas Sir, and her new film, Reject. We're also joined by her father, prison psychologist Herbert Thomas, and author of The Shame Response to Rejection. He says the rejection some inmates have experienced can be the cause that led to their violence. You know, the impact we've been talking about, how there's a physiological element and how rejection, ostracism lead to shame, which leads to anger, which leads to violence. So I just wonder, in your experience, I mean, in the prisons, we could imagine that, of course, a lot of these men may have ended up in prison because of histories of rejection and shame that leads to anger and violence. What can be done to help people who have experienced this in their childhood? It's set up, a very deep-seated shame, maybe made them far more sensitive to rejection. And here I have to say, I mean, I was bullied as a child, and I was ostracized as a child. I was not bullied. I was ostracized. I was different than the other kids. I had grown up in Mexico for the first 3 years of my life. My parents were, you know, proto-hippies. This was in the 1950s. We moved to suburban New Jersey. I mean, I was like from another planet. And the kids completely rejected me until I found one friend who was very, very smart and really accepted me and really gave me an understanding of that it wasn't my fault. But I can say I still suffer from the effects of the social ostracism. They never go away. What can we do with people who have suffered this? How can this be healed on an individual basis first?
It's very hard that people can change, because these things are, if you think of the mind in terms of levels, at the very deepest level, if this pain is present, it's very hard to get in touch with it, and so often the person is surprised when they experience another rejection, because it too can trigger off a great deal of pain. But I think educating people, as Ruth's film does in the most wonderful way, is very helpful to people. I think it gives them something to hang on to when they're trying to change the course of their lives. But I just want to give an awful lot of credit to this Kipling Williams, this professor of social psychology or social sciences. What happened was that he was out in a park and two men were throwing a frisbee back and forth to each other. And one happened to throw it in the wrong direction, essentially, but over to Kip, who picked it up and threw it back. He didn't think anything of it. But they started sending it back and forth to him. And for about 5 minutes, maybe, he was one of the three frisbee throwers. That stopped when they started throwing it back and forth to themselves again. The pain that he experienced with that rejection, as he perceived it, they didn't reject him, they just stopped throwing the frisbee to him. When they stopped throwing it to him and he had this physical pain in his body that was severe, this man had the wisdom to say, if I feel this, then other people must feel it.
Are you saying that if people really do understand the source of their shame cognitively or intellectually, that they can begin to heal, or is there a certain kind of therapy that can work?
Well, I think any kind of therapy that's based on acceptance, you know, there are people that are working in the field of positive psychology. I don't know that much about it. I would imagine it's based in these principles, Francesca. Relationships that are healthy, relationships that are accepting, that accept you for who you are. I mean, it may sound simple, but this is actually very powerful to combat the negative effects of rejection. I mean, Eric Mohat's story, you know, he may have survived the bullying, but to be rejected by the core group of friends on top of being bullied, that is pure isolation. And as a teenager, your brain is wired to connect with other teenagers, no matter how loving your family is. But I would say even as an adult, it's not hopeless. What I would say is we want to get this information out because there's so much shame around the shame. I think Eric felt very, very alone. Something came out later, years later, where Eric was standing outside of the hallway and crying on the day that he died. And at least one person did come over. A lot of people didn't, but one person did. And they said, you know, are you okay? And he said, I don't want to bother anyone with it. Now, this is a boy who shared a lot with his family, who was best friends with his sister. But the shame, I think, really can shut people down, isolate people even more. That's kind of the trick of it. So I think it's opening that up and making people realize this is so universal. Dad referred to Kip Williams' work. The main message of Cyberball is that we are hardwired to detect ostracism, exclusion, and rejection. Our brains are hardwired to detect it. We all feel it. It's how we process it, which is different. So some of us, based on our life history, based on our DNA, a lot of different things, we're going to be able to react to our life situations differently. But his research shows that it is 100% universal that people experience it, and it even shows up as physical pain in the brain. So there's much, much more research to be done, I believe, but just getting this message out of how it is universal, it affects all of us, I think can reduce the shame, and I think it's healing.
We're talking with Ruth Thomas about her film Reject. It's about social ostracism and social acceptance as the antidote to that. And also with her father, who has written a book about the shame response to rejection, which is its title. Now, I wondered, as I was looking at this film and also reading excerpts from your book, Herb, anger is what... The shame is suppressed. The anger is the first response that's really felt. I wonder if anger is a way to not feel the pain of rejection. Is there some physiological thing that happens when people go to anger that in some way soothes or masks the pain?
Yes, absolutely. What happens is that when we're rejected, and let's agree for the moment in this example that we feel a great deal of pain because of the rejection, our muscles become very tense when we're in severe pain. And one way of discharging this muscle tension is to express anger, to become enraged, and therefore it calms you down, but only for the moment. It's really not useful. It helps, but it doesn't change the bottom line, which is you've got this pain of past rejections, and somehow you've got to be able to objectify this. What one has to do, and either meditate or talk to someone else that you trust, when you express the feelings of a situation in which you were shamed and felt pain, what you have to do is you have got to work it through. You can't get around it. You can't avoid it. You've got, if there's some particular situation that you feel experience tremendous rejection and pain, you've got to objectify the experience. In other words, you've got to be able to stand back and say, okay, what happened in this situation? What does it tell me about the other person that I experience shame from? Because all of us will go, if we experience shame, to, okay, what have I done wrong? That's going to go nowhere. What you have to do is, what does that experience of her shaming me, rejecting me. What does that tell me about her?
Yeah, I think that's very important. I just loved the last frame mm-hmm. of your film, Ruth Thomas, this film, Reject. The little boy, Justin, I believe his name is, his classroom has just, they've just stopped doing this wonderful game in which they are all cooperating with each other. They're all playing together, including the teacher. And then they all start filing out of the gym, and he turns back and gives a leap of just such pure ebullience and joy. And you catch him in that moment. And it just, you know, I had to watch that over and over again just to get a really nice shot of happiness. I want to ask you about, you know, this is a beautifully edited film. Talk a little bit about the process of weaving these personal stories, the story of Justin, the story of Eric, and everything else together. How did you manage to do it to make it such a wonderfully seamless whole?
Well, I'll tell you, it was a real team effort. And Peter Brower is our fabulous editor, and Kurt Engfer was sort of our consulting editor, co-producer. The three of us are producers on the movie. But I'll tell you, it was extremely challenging. And there were days I just thought, how are these three strands going to come together? And anyone that's done editing knows that it's built like a house of cards. So you move one teeny little thing and then the whole thing can fall apart. So what we did, Peter and I were working here, we started to weave the three strands, the three narratives together very early on. And then Kurt came in and said, no, 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 stop, roll back. So we had these three stories. We started to weave them together, but he felt that we really hadn't developed the three stories. He said, you have to do each of them individually. And that was really great advice. So we went back to the drawing board and we did science just in and of itself. Then we did Eric's story in and of itself. And then we looked at the Oklahoma story, Justin, You Can't Say You Can't Play, as a whole other narrative. And that took months and months to really get those right. And we were still tweaking those way down the line. And then we were finally ready to start weaving them together. And then that was, I'll just tell you, thousands of hours of conversations and discussions, sometimes fights. And then we'd come to another place.
Well, for example, Eric's story, you know, you start the film with it, and then you leave it. Mm-hmm. And you go to Justin, mm-hmm. or you go to the science, and then it comes back in. And when it comes back in, it seems to come in right at that point where it just seems exactly right. I mean, that's what really struck me. I mean, did you see a point in the narrative and say, oh, I remember something back where in Eric's story?
Yes, that's kind of how it goes. And it's hard to tell you exactly because it's a very organic process. But you really are looking, you know, you're having the conversation of, do we tell the audience right away that Eric has died? Do we not tell him that? I mean, there are literally hundreds of conversations like that. But Kurt, in his wisdom, told us we would start to see the connections and we would start to see where it would make sense to go from one thing to another. And then sometimes you want a certain sequence to live in a certain place, but it can't because it doesn't make sense coming out of something else. So it was really a real puzzle. It was a real puzzle and very challenging at times, but exciting when it would start to click together.
So how can people see this film?
So people can see Reject right now in community screenings. So if you just check rejectfilm.com, there might be one happening near you. You can also email us at rejectfilm.com and request a community screening if you can gather a group. And we expect to be out streaming and on DVD and available for home and educational use, hopefully by the summer of 2014. But there are many places to see it before that.
Well, Herb Thomas and Ruth Thomas, thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice. It's a really wonderful film, and I urge my listeners to find a place to see it or bring it to your community.
Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you so much.
Ruth Thomas, sir, and Herbert Thomas. Go to writersvoice.net for a link to the trailer for the film Reject. Next, journalist John Cushman on the Keystone XL pipeline and the just-released State Department report. Stay tuned. ¶¶ If you were reading or listening to the news this week, you might have heard about the State Department's Environmental Impact Statement report on the Keystone XL pipeline. If so, you probably think it gave its blessing for the pipeline to go forward. At least that's what most of the media seem to think. But the reality is much more complicated than that. In fact, the report raised some real questions that environmentalists will be using as ammunition in the continuing fight over whether Keystone will be built. I called up long-term environmental journalist John Cushman, now working with Inside Climate News, to explain. We only have time to play a small portion of the interview, but you'll find the rest at writersvoice.net. Now, the press has widely reported that the recent release of the State Department's Environmental Impact Statement on the Keystone XL pipeline would not have a significant environmental impact. Is that true?
Well, the report does not say that. It doesn't say it outright. And it's a simple question that doesn't really lend itself to a yes or no answer. The logic of the report was the same as the draft, and the draft report had language like that in it, but they were very careful to take that language out. And instead what they said is that a single pipeline or a single infrastructure project would be unlikely to have a major effect on the growth of production of tar sands in Canada or on the demand for that kind of fuel among refineries on the Texas Gulf. You can read into that what you like about greenhouse gas emissions, but the report actually does not come out and say that, and it does have some more nuanced messages about greenhouse gas emissions.
Yeah, I mean, I was reading on Inside Climate News, I was reading the Twitter feed on the issue, and it seemed like a lot of environmentalists were celebrating what the report said. And that surprised me because until I read that, the media story I'd been getting was that it was a defeat for environmentalists.
I would say the best that you can say right now is that the environmentalists continue to see a path forward in their crusade against the pipeline. They know that this report did not make a recommendation. They know that it is not the last step in the process. And they know that it contains some ammunition for them that they can take advantage of. At the same time, there's a lot of in this report that they view as very flawed, and they may have grounds for a lawsuit challenging the report under NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act. There's a lot of directions they can go. But they did manage to find, I would say, a silver lining. I think on balance, you have to say that this report was more favorable to the proponents of the pipeline than it was to the opponents, at least in the broad political campaign. When you get down in the nuts and bolts, this is a big, long, complicated report, and there's a lot of material in there for the two sides to use.
What were some of the things that we can find as ammunition against the pipeline?
Well, I'll tell you one thing. There's a line in the detailed chapter on the life cycle analysis of this fuel that says flat out that one of the clear conclusions that emerged from all the studies that they did is that if you approve the pipeline, it would raise the carbon footprint of transportation fuels burned in the United States. There's a complicated reason for saying that, but that's something that they can use. Another thing that they are hanging their hopes on is a section that says that at low prices for oil, it becomes more important to the tar sands operators to have the pipeline available, and that some projects in the tar sands would not be economical and might be abandoned if the pipelines were canceled in a setting of low oil prices. And although prices for oil are not that low today, they've been that low in the recent past, and it's hard to say whether they'll ever get that low again. Partly it depends on other policies. There are a lot of policies that the United States and the world might pursue as they attempt to keep the climate within safe boundaries that would severely restrict the demand for oil. In that kind of setting, the price of oil would go down and the tar sands would no longer be economical.
So you're talking, say, for example, a carbon tax or putting the price of carbon at something like $100?
Those are two examples, but let me put it somewhat differently.
Mm-hmm.
It's very important for the world not to build a large number of big, capital-intensive, permanent pieces of infrastructure which lock in carbon emissions. And this pipeline, whatever you might think about it, is a big, large infrastructure project that will lock in the emissions of the fuels that it carries for the next 50 years. And that's a lot of emissions. Now, this comes at a time when all the nations of the world are beginning to see that it's important to reduce their carbon emissions together. The United States has pledged to reduce them 17% in the next few years, 50% in the next couple of decades, and 80% by the middle of the century. And it's important to do that in order to escape dangerous global warming. This is the consensus of the IPCC and the other scientific mainstream analysts. Everybody from the World Bank to the International Monetary Fund to the Secretary General of the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, to the Secretary General of the UN, the World Bank, everybody agrees that we have to move rapidly to a decarbonized economy to escape global warming. And for all these institutions to agree that that's the direction we're going into, it just makes it important to look for some large infrastructure projects that we don't build because they put us on the wrong path. And I think that's the argument that the environmentalists can find most persuasive, that something's got to give. There is some evidence in this report to support that point of view. Whatever you think about whether the pipeline would encourage growth in the tar sands or not, the fuel that moves through that pipeline will have a carbon footprint. The carbon that comes from that fuel will add up to about 150 million tons a year. Over 50 years, that comes out to 7.5 billion tons of carbon. That's an amount of carbon greater than what the U.S. as a whole puts out in 1 year. It's an amount of carbon that's greater than all the carbon savings that we're getting from new regulations to increase fuel efficiency in cars. So there's little question that the fuel that moves through that pipeline is going to emit carbon. The argument here is over whether that fuel, if it doesn't move through this pipeline, is going to move through another pipeline, or is going to move by rail, or is going to go to another market like Asia or another market like Europe. And the economic analysis, the market analysis, that's a conventional business-as-usual analysis that the State Department hired contractors to produce for them, views the world oil market as being like a waterbed. And if you sit on one corner of it and the water goes down in that corner, it's just going to pop up someplace else. It views it almost as a force of nature that oil from the tar sands is going to be produced as long as there's money to be made up there. That's the Canadian perspective on this under the current Canadian government. But a sophisticated argument can look at some of the materials from this report and say, now it's Obama and Kerry's turn to analyze our national interest in whether we want this pipeline to move across our territory to our refineries and to be handled in this way. And that analysis goes beyond a business-as-usual case and includes our nation's broader objectives and all the other policies that the administration is pursuing, and asks whether this policy is cohesive with the rest of the policy landscape.
That's a good segue into next question, because as you point out, the idea that the oil will be taken out of the ground is being treated as inevitable, as just a fact. But in fact, there's a huge and growing global and domestic movement to keep it in the ground.
Well, that's right. And there's ample evidence from the science and the economics that, you know, we know what our carbon budget is as a planet. We know how much carbon dioxide can be added to the atmosphere in the next 50 or 100 years and still give us a chance, not a certainty, but a chance of staying within a reasonably safe amount of warming. These are ranges and risks. None of these numbers should be treated as being absolute numbers. It's complicated business to do the math. But directionally, we know what the answer is. And that is that there's only so much carbon dioxide. The oil and coal and natural gas industry already have enough proven reserves to fully meet that budget, and that basically 80% of it has to stay in the ground.
So now my final question. I just wonder if there was anything also in that environmental impact statement that looked at how the approval of a pipeline like this would continue a longstanding policy of favoring the fossil fuel industries. In other words, you know, there's an opportunity cost. If you support something like this, it can send a signal that you're not going to be supporting the robust transition to clean energy.
Yeah, I think this is where the next phase of the process, the national interest determination, plays its part. There, they can consider the national interest in whatever form or shape they want to define it, and they're really open to these kind of broad questions. As to the environmental impact statement itself, I would make a couple of comments. It's very odd that when you're asked to do an environmental impact statement of a decision to grant a permit to a project, that the whole thrust of the analysis is what would be the results if we denied the permit to the project, or if, in other words, if we did nothing. This turns the NEPA analysis upside down. You're supposed to be addressing the environmental impacts of the project that's in question, not saying, well, let's look in a mirror and imagine what would happen if we didn't do this project. Would anything be different? No, we don't think it would. Therefore, the project is benign. That's just an odd way to look at it. Now, the second thing that I would say about this, under the NEPA law, you're required to do cumulative analysis. In other words, you can't just look at one project and in a vacuum, separated from all similar projects or from the totality of the problems that we face. The emissions from any single greenhouse gas emission are trivial compared to the gigantic effect of all of these things. So NEPA requires that you do cumulative analysis. And if you look at this cumulatively, then you see, well, the emissions from this project over 50 years are going to add up to as much as the United States gives off, you know, the whole country in 1 year. And since carbon dioxide does build up in the atmosphere, it literally accumulates in the atmosphere, and it's the accumulation that causes global warming. And the accumulation of things that happen today will be felt for 100 or 200 years. You really need to pay attention to this. Well, the State Department actually has two pipeline applications under consideration right now. There's another application from Enbridge, and both of these applications are underway simultaneously. Nowhere in this report is there any attempt to say even these two things taken together are bigger than either one of them. And so the report says no single project is going to have any effect. How about two projects? If you're allowed to take the rationale that is being taken in this report, then I'd have to say it would never be appropriate to stop any pipeline on the basis of its effects on greenhouse gas emissions. And therefore, to use the term, there was one oil industry executive who said, I'm for all pipelines everywhere. If you approve this one pipeline, you're declaring that you're for all pipelines everywhere. And if you're for all pipelines everywhere, then you're really not leading in a direction of turning around our carbon emissions and heading them radically downward to the point that you get to a zero carbon economy. So I think that this failure to address the cumulative emissions in a serious way, that may be the Achilles heel of this whole analysis.
That was John Cushman, a journalist in Washington since the mid-70s. He covered the EPA for the New York Times and now works with Inside Climate News, the online news site that won a Pulitzer Prize last year for its report, The Dilbit Disaster, an investigation into the million-gallon spill of Canadian tar sands oil into the Kalamazoo River in 2010. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.